Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm once again joined by Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing?
How's it, Nick? I'm doing all right. See you on the East End.
Very good. And, of course, the venerable Mr. Herman Pretorius in Pretoria, the nation's capital. Herman, how are you?
I'm fine. Older than I was the other day, but I'm guessing that's what happens when, you know, time moves in a linear direction. So
just let our listeners and viewers know, it was Haran's birthday over the weekend.
Yes. And I must say,
how old did you turn?
He's now old enough to vote and to drink legally, I believe.
Yes, now I must say, I'm now 30 years old, and I must say I feel a lot more like Marius. This morning when I got out of bed, I realized I didn't have a good foot.
We'll just let you know, Herman, things don't get better.
Thank you very much.
Are you really 30?
Yes. This baby face hides a lot of life experience.
And I thought, you know, I had this horrible thing happen to me last year where I thought I was 27, but then it turned out I was 28, which was very disconcerting. Anyway. Okay, enough of that. Let us get into it. And, of course, the story, which refuses to go away because it is probably one of the most important things to happen in South Africa for a very long time, is the week of anarchy, chaos, and general no goodness that we saw from the across the country. And as always happens, various groups, politicians, thinkers, we're all trying to make sense of this, and so narratives start to appear. And the main narrative that seems to be coming from President Cyril Ramaphosa is that this was an insurrection, an attempt by undemocratic forces, and the sort of, he doesn't say it out loud, but it's kind of suggested that it's Zoomerite people, an attempt to overthrow South Africa's democracy. And Cyril Ramaphosa has said it, and as many words. And in fact, many people in the mainstream media who are supporters of Zuma and also the Twitter mob has very much taken this idea of the insurrection on board. But it's got a bit awkward because the defense minister recently in a press conference was said, no, it wasn't an insurgency. It was, quote, criminal counter-revolutionaries. She went on to say, we are not seeing signs of a coup or insurgency, but rather counter-revolution creeping in the form of criminality and thuggery. This was designed to sow the seeds of division in the country. And of course, this is the exact opposite of what Cyril Ramaphosa was saying, where he said the ensuing chaos is used as a smokescreen to carry out economic sabotage through targeted attacks on trucks, factories, warehouses, and other infrastructure necessary for the functioning of our economy. If we stand together, no insurrectional violence in this country will succeed. So it's a bit awkward because was it an insurrection, as the president says, or was it simply criminality that served a counter-revolutionary purpose, as the defense minister said? This is a question that I think has excited a lot of people. And our CEO, Franz Kronier, came down on the side of saying that whatever insurrectionary mischief was going on, the real problem here was the criminality, chaos, and desperation. So, Marius, let me start with you. What do you make of all this? What do you make of this whole idea of the deliberate insurrection to overthrow the government, as the president has suggested?
Look, I don't think it was. I think there might have been some directed violence in the beginning from people linked to Jacob Zuma, but I don't think the widespread violence we saw was directed by him. I think it was a combination of criminality, a combination of having 40% unemployment in the country, over 50% unemployment in KwaZulu-Natal outside of Durban, 75% unemployment amongst people aged between 15 and 24 in South Africa. And if we look at the targets they were attacked, sure, you can say there was infrastructure, there was a lot of macro warehouses, for example, were attacked and looted, or various retail warehouses. But the like in a coup or an insurrection to overthrow the government, those are the kind of places that aren't attacked. Places that are attacked are where the government's headquarters would be, or the national broadcaster, or the airport, or all that kind of thing, which we didn't see. Police stations, exactly. So while I can maybe buy that some of this was directed in the initial stages, maybe the initial attacks we saw on the Moy River Toll Plaza, but those also have been going back for years. That's always been a dangerous stretch of highway, and we saw that happening when Jacob Zuma was president too. So I don't think this was a coordinated insurrection or coup. It was limited to KwaZulu-Natal and parts of Gauteng, which are both provinces with the largest Zulu population. So there might have been some kind of grievance because of what happened to Jacob Zuma, but I'm not sure that's what it was. I think maybe there might have been some ethnic mobilization, but I definitely don't think this was coordinated insurrection or anything like that. I think it's the boiling pot that comes when you have high levels of unemployment in South Africa, high levels of poverty. And for a lot of people, you know, in any country where you have lots of young people, especially young men, unemployed, it leads to instability. It's an iron rule around the world. And that is what's happening in South Africa. There are lots of people who, especially young people, who feel like they have no hope. And they don't, I mean, they don't really have a stake in the system. So, you know, go loot, go burn things down. Obviously, it's not condoning these things that happen, but that is what happens when you have large number of people who feel hopelessness and despair, and that is what we saw last week. I don't think it was a coordinated attack against the government. If it had been, we would have seen different things happen, and we didn't.
So our colleague Gabriel Krause has made, I think, a good point to support what you're saying there, Marius, which is that there's lots of places in this country where infrastructure is quite vulnerable and would be very easy to destroy, to cause enormous chaos. So everything from power stations to the example he gives is there's a fuel pipeline that runs from the coast up to Gauteng, and there's a point at it in which someone basically with a monkey wrench or machete could sever the supply of fuel to Johannesburg and throw the country into total economic chaos. Mm. And things like that didn't quite happen. We did see a lot of TVs being carried away in Toyota Tazzas, but not and much another else.
Another point just to make is that we often see infrastructure get attacked during service delivery protests. It happens every major service delivery protest. Schools get burned down, the local municipal office or the local clinic, and I think that's also part of it. People, this is also a way of ordinary South Africans, I think, showing their anger. It was basically a service delivery protest writ large.
Herman, what do you make of this? Do you agree with what Morris is saying?
Yes, and I think there's a bit of a telltale giveaway here. It's a rule of PR in politics that when you look weak as a leader, flank yourself with the military and the police, and really, you know, establish the state or regalia of military and violent power to be on your side. I mean, you see it across the world. It's one of those really old adages. The moment a politician starts appearing with the police and the military, you know they are worried that they are looking weak in the eyes of the people. I mean, you can see it from George W. Bush to Tony Abbott in Australia. At points when their popularity and their influence are really at the lowest ebb, they reach for the law and order, military, you know, police, we will establish, we've got right on our side type of stance. And to make that a reality, you need things like the war on terror. Not that I'm saying that's a fiction, but you need to have a deliberate, you know, a threat to which you could respond to with some, you know, coherence at least. So George Bush had the war on terror. Tony Abbott in Australia had the stopping the boats and the Chinese criminal gangs infiltrating the Australian northern cities. So you have to identify an unidentifiable bogeyman. You have to flank yourself with military and police powers, and that's the way you, from a political PR standpoint, assert the fact that you're in charge. And I think that's the desperate attempt that's going on here now. When President Ramaphosa came up and he had a guy from the military and a guy from the police standing there, I'm like, oh, yep, this is the Tony Abbott playbook. I saw this happen in 2014, 2015. This is the playbook. This is literally the thing. It's the recipe that you put in place. So if you take that into account, then you realize why they have to manufacture an insurgency. But then you also look at what they did. Did they then go on to behave like a government fearing insurgency? No. In the US and in Australia, at least these leaders have had the gumption to follow through against this bogeyman they've identified. I think we've seen Carl Niels arrested, some rando somewhere in the Karoo arrested, and then elf people, 11 people, sorry. My cards just threw in the word elf there. And 11.
You're not talking about people with pointy ears who live for a very long time.
No, I must say that's a whole different topic that we can take on about accents and Finnish. But the thing is that the government hasn't behaved like a government fearing insurrection.
Yeah, this is a point that Franz Crenier made this morning in our morning meeting, that the government says that these 12 instigators who just attempted to overthrow democracy and the constitution, and they've arrested one of them already, and the other 11 are under
observation, like
because we're waiting for them to
exactly. But also this guy, this Thulani Dhlomo, who the Daily Maverick said was kind of Zuma's mastermind, and we've been hearing that he was this master spy behind all this. Apparently he went to hand himself in at a police station. They said, why are you handing yourself in? There's no warrant for... No, he can go home. Don't worry about it. So if he was this mastermind, surely there'd be a nationwide manhunt for this guy. He went to the police station, how's it? Yeah, guys. And he said, no, you can go home. It's fine. You don't want it for anything.
So there was a suggestion this morning that we interview Carl Niehaus on this show. And then we'll be able to find decisively prove that, in fact, there is no mastermind, because he has been described as one of the masterminds. And perhaps an interview with him might dispel that notion. I don't know what our listeners suggestion.
I would like to propose that we start calling Carl Niehaus, as there was a news program from overseas where they're talking about Carl Niehaus and they pronounce his surname as Niehaus. So I think the proposal to call him Carl Niehaus going forward.
But I think one thing that we have to just make a distinction is that we're not saying this was unorganized. We're just saying it wasn't an overarching, or we're not saying that there weren't elements of organization going into this.
I mean, is this when, where was it? Sorry to interrupt, Harry, but was not Tulamela, I think, in Limpopo, Mpumalanga, where the people wanted the municipality moved to the other province, either from Mpumalanga to Limpopo, and their schools were burnt down, and the people, like, things did not carry on in that municipality normally for, I think, was pretty close to a year. Was that an insurrection, or was that just people who were hurtful and want the government to listen to them?
Exactly, and I think the point we were making just before we came on air is that, the point I made is that, you know, we live in a country where it's not difficult to believe that organized crime is more organized than the government. So that if circumstances on the ground are, you know, fruitful for some efficient crime, right, we can expect from a country with this high level of criminality to have some organized crime units cashing in on that. So, of course, there would have been elements of organization. But not the same as saying this was, you know, an attempted coup against democracy.
If you see the mall is being looted and you're a gang that robs ATMs and blows them up and cuts them open, it's a really great time to go to the mall and cut open the ATMs and steal all the money inside. Of this interaction... Yeah, sure, go ahead, Morris.
I was going to say, I mean, any coup also has to have some kind of level of popular support. And I mean, even Jacob Zuma at the end of his presidency had his approval rating was 25%, down from nearly 70% when he became president. So, I mean, I doubt there's anything approaching any level of popular support for a Zuma-backed coup in KwaZulu-Natal too. I don't think Zuma has particularly high levels of support in KwaZulu-Natal. And I think outside of KwaZulu-Natal, they're basically negligible.
Well, you at least need the taxi drivers on your side, and outside of KZN, it looks like the taxi drivers are against you.
and I must say, for me, the real golden rule for African coups is whether the military has gone onto the national broadcaster to say this is not a coup. And we did not see that. So unless we see, the day we see the military occupying SABC saying this is not a coup, that's how you know it's a coup. We didn't see any of the strategic important stuff. We didn't see organization and criminality. And of course, you saw an escalation of some of the violence and disorder and lawlessness and mob justice that already plagues massive parts of our country. But it's not difficult to see these things just, you know, being swept up in a confluence of opportunism, anger, frustration, and violence, and then a government desperately trying to save face and saying, oh yes, our lives were threatened, and you know.
And I think that is opportunism is actually the point that Paula Kernan is making in the chat, which says, what about the theft of all that ammunition? I think that's exactly what it was. I think it was opportunism. Probably opportunistic theft by criminal gangs, what have you. I doubt it was people plotting a coup. But I think we're probably going to see in the media, it's already happening on social media, people saying, look at Cyril Ramaphosa, the great democratically elected leader, which he is. He's certainly the legitimate leader of South Africa. And
he's a democratically elected leader, but he's not the great leader.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know that he faced down these forces of darkness, and now we must all support the president. And now maybe this is why we need more restrictions on social media speech and maybe other kinds of speech, because we can't let this kind of thing happen again. And I think we'll just be very careful of that. I mean, I certainly agree that President Ramaphosa, we must definitely not overthrow him. The only way you get rid of the ANC and President Ramaphosa at the ballot box. But we must be very careful to not make this seem as if there is this great threat against the president and there'll be certain restrictions placed on people to stop this imaginary threat.
And right. And I think there's also something worth to be made that ammunition being stolen indicates as much of, you know, the instigation of a populist coup as televisions being stolen instigate the, you know, creation of a massive populist news studio. So I think opportunism gives rise to the theft of all manner of valuable goods. And if you look at the country and you understand that there are some significant pressures on firearms ownership and trade and those kind of things, it makes sense that these are valuable goods within these times, like televisions.
And ammo's expensive, man. I don't own a firearm, although I'm an aspirant firearm owner, especially after what's just happened. Maybe next time there's some looting, I should go and get myself some as well. But anyway,
the closest I get to ammo is Amo Amas Amat Amamus Amatis Amant, which is the declension of Latin. That's the level of my street cred. Is that I can possibly confuse people coming at me by giving them a question that they can't understand the tense of.
Harriman, your street cred is so low that it hadn't been paved yet, the street that you're on.
Yeah, it's so low the Zimbabwean Reserve Bank printed it.
I see someone is asking in the chat, has the Zulu royal family made a statement? Yes, I think they did. They condemned it, saying that the Zulu nation was leading itself into suicide by taking part.
I thought it was a very measured, good statement by the New Zulu king, I thought.
Yeah. All right, so let us move on to what President Ramaphosa's solution for all of this is. So, of course, he's sort of suggesting here that maybe there was a bit more than an insurrection, that by looking at his solution here, he says that in order for government to fix this problem and show South Africa that they care, they need to adopt a basic income grant. So what's that? That's basically a form of welfare where if you have no job, no income or anything like that, you get a small amount of money per month. So basically you can buy the basic foodstuffs. President Ramaphosa said this will validate our people and show them that we are giving serious consideration to their lives. We are giving active consideration to the grinding poverty that we continue to see in our country. We need to address the structural inequalities in our economy. And the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, has endorsed this call. So let me start with you, Herman. What do you make of a basic income grant?
Well, the first thing I think we should make of it is that I've never seen a leader narrowly survive a coup and then suggest a solution to the coup is a new socioeconomic policy. I mean, that's just a betrayal of the fact that this, obviously, not even the president believes this was an insurrection. He knows that this was a socioeconomic opportunist collapse of criminality and, you know, anger. Okay, so what to make of a universal, basic income grant? I think that it's a fair debate to have. I mean, whether that is something that can actually work. I mean, there are libertarian and classical liberal ideas like Milton Friedman's negative income tax that sort of can be classified as this sort of state support for poor people struggling to get jobs. But you can have those discussions and debates when you're in a country that isn't perhaps looking at the national debt nearing 100% of annual GDP. You can look at that debate when you actually have money to spend. And that's what is really grinding my gears as we head out of this period of chaos, is we shouldn't be happy with the explanations offered by the government we shouldn't be happy with just the violence tempering down, because what caused this in the first place were policy issues that made people poor and just denigrated societies and social fabric and led to this form of desperation, lawlessness, and opportunism. But the problem we now have is to go right. We can't just be happy that it is stopped. We can't just be happy that the coup did not succeed. We have to actually look properly at what happened here. And looking at something like a basic income grant is essentially ignoring every piece of sensible advice when it comes to responsible fiscal management. A government spending itself into crisis mode, seeing that crisis mode spill onto the streets in the form of violence, then thinking, the solution is more spending, really calls for a people to take a stand and get involved and, you know, just do the basic thing of getting criticism out there, even if it is in a WhatsApp group or next to a society over a fire. We really must take this seriously, because these types of policies, very interesting, a lot going for it, but not in a country where we have seen the collapse of fiscal responsibility that only, 15 years ago gave us so much reason to be proud as an emerging African market.
No, I think that's definitely right. I think there's good arguments both for and against a basic income grant, but it's kind of a moot point if, there are no jobs, because how are you going to fund such a thing? And B, the country's already bankrupt, so you can't even, you know, where they're going to scratch the money together. We already can barely sustain our current social spending net, which is mostly just disability grants, child grants, old age pensions. You know, adding another one on top of that, which is 40% of the population is going to qualify for it at least. Not feasible in terms of money. Morris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm actually not opposed to a universal basic income grant in principle. Just exactly Harriman's point. You have to pay for it, and I mean, unless the economy is growing, which is not, and doesn't look like the government's going to put in place policies which let the economy grow, the only other option is to turn on the old money printer, and that ends well for anybody.
Yes. But, north of the border, what happens then?
Exactly. But if you want to stop, if you want to get people to live in dignity and be able to have hope for the future and not have what happened in the last week happen again, the solution is jobs. It's easy to say that's a solution. We have to determine how we get the jobs to people. Every single policy, I think Peter Bruce has made this point before, every single policy in South Africa that's got to have one outcome, and is, does it create jobs? If it doesn't, then forget about it. It has to create jobs. And I mean, as I said now, I mean, in KwaZulu-Natal, outside of Durban, it's got an unemployment rate of 53% or something. It's the second highest in the country, I think, outside of the Eastern Cape, outside of Buffalo City and Nelson Mandela Bay. I mean, that is worse than depression-era levels. I think at the heart of depression, the U.S. had 30% unemployment, I think. I'm open to correction, though. But never got to 50%. And, I mean, apart from, you know, just the normal, the macroeconomic stuff of people, you know, the economy's, the gears of the economy slow down because people don't have money to spend. It's also talking about people's dignity, waking up every day, not having a job, nothing, not having anything to go do, not being able to provide for your family, not being able to just go be able to buy a beer on a Friday to forget, you know, just to relax a bit, not even have money to do that kind of thing. It's really, it's a terrible thing. And that's one thing. It really takes dignity away from people. And that's the one thing we have to concentrate on. How do we get South Africans, how do we get jobs to South Africans?
Yeah. I will say, though, that I think that there is, that the law and order element is also important here, because while, of course, poverty does contribute to lawlessness, the weakness of the police certainly does too. And I'm thinking of what I thought was the most darkly humorous story of the last year, which was that CEO of a wealth management firm who was arrested for looting.
Ubuntu Wealth Management, Nochal.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, okay, clearly, and he stole, what was it? It was booze, a bar stool, a washing machine.
And wasn't also a bicycle or something?
Yeah, something like that. And you just think to yourself, money's not the problem here. Like, this is just a kind of guy who he needs to go to jail. And if the police worked properly, he would never have even thought of it. And if he did, he would have been arrested straight away. Now, like, thankfully, he was arrested. So that's good. But the police need to be stronger.
Nick, I want to add another element, because I think actually that we've added two of the three core ingredients to a stable society. Number one is upward mobility in terms of socioeconomic hope and ambition. Number two is a reliable law and order structure. And number three is property rights. The fact that, where did we see citizens step up to actually effect proper resistance to this sort of lawlessness? It was there where communities understood they had skin in the game. They had things to lose if violence were to overwhelm A, B, or C. And the reason for that was they had ownership of their society. Imagine that same sort of protectiveness over the basic things like homes and schools. Those three things, upward social mobility, or the chance to get that law and order and property rights, that's the cocktail for a safer and prosperous society.
I don't know if you saw that video over the weekend. It was a kind of youngish, I don't know, maybe mid-30s black dude who was very heavily armed, civilian guy. He was being interviewed by the media, and he said the shops, the malls and stuff in this area, they belong, the township economy belongs to the people of the township, and we need to defend it from looters and lawlessness, because otherwise we're going to suffer. And that was exactly that point you're illustrating there. He understood it exactly, and he went out there, put his life on the line to defend that stuff with his own firearms. So a good argument for why civilians should be able to have firearms.
And Nick, the two last comments I quickly want to look at here is, the sooner the ANC steps down, the sooner things will change. Yes, but the ANC won't step down. If every South African who voted against the ANC in 2019 in the next election can find one South Africa who did not vote in the previous election and convince them to cast a ballot against the ANC and against the EFF, against this ideology of state control and racism, then we can kick out the current lot in one fell swoop. That's the point of a democracy. We are sitting in a country where more people who could have voted did not vote than voted for the ANC. That is the sort of thing that we must change. We cannot have this outsourcing of thinking, hoping that they will step down. If you haven't tried to convince a non-voter to become a voter, I suggest you try it as a first step of civic engagement and getting involved. And then the second point of Alexia Simon here, the youth are sold a lie that if you study hard and get a qualification, that you will get a job and start your life. They are very disillusioned right now and angry, and we are seeing the results. Yes, yes and no. I mean, part of this isn't an unemployed youth just, you know, looting the televisions, because that's not the actions of someone socioeconomically desperate. That's someone criminally opportune. And the problem here isn't necessarily that the qualifications, it's that the qualifications have become so meaningless that they don't promote you in any way to actually have the skills you need. Numeracy, literacy, these things aren't quality. If we can get to a point where it's easier to hire someone who's illiterate and perhaps 16 years old, get them to upskill as a young plumber or boilermaker or carpenter, that's a route out of the socioeconomic quagmire.
But that is also a thing that's forgotten often. An entry-level job often opens up paths to getting better skills, being upskilled, and then obviously earning more. It's kind of a virtuous circle. But obviously, if you can't even get that entry-level job, then we have a problem.
Right. All right. I'm afraid that is all the time we have for today. So we were also going to talk about municipal debt for 5 of our metros being downgraded to junk status, but we don't have time for that. So I just want to say thank you very much to everyone for watching. Please subscribe to us. Please like us. Please review us. All those things if you enjoy the show. We really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who's also commenting and engaging. It's great to hear from you guys. And I hope that you have a wonderful week. And we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.